Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to another ChrisMartinson.com podcast. I am your host, of course, Chris Martinson. And today we have a very special interview guest, me. This is part two of a series where you ask the questions and I respond to them. And I have, again, Adam Taggart, my partner, here with me today to ask the questions.
Hi, Chris. Good to be with you again.
How is everything out there in California?
It's finally getting sunny and dry. Believe it or not, while it's been pretty warm and sunny your way, it's been a little bit wetter out here.
It was wet when I was there last. You know, we have summer here right now, so we just skipped the whole spring thing.
I guess so. I hear it's 80 degrees in Chicago this week. Crazy.
Yeah, it is crazy, but here we are.
All right, well, you're ready to dive back in?
I am.
All right, well, we've got a number of questions that we didn't get to last time, plus we had a bunch of new questions come in after people heard the first interview. So, again, we'll get through as many as we can, and something tells me that we're going to make this a bit of a regular occurrence going forward.
Excellent.
All right. Question number one comes from user Shep Video. What's the most likely course for the Great Contraction? Do you see a financial crash and chaos, or a more gradual deleveraging through inflation as energy costs rise?
The most likely course, the most probable course, is exactly the course that we're in right now. I've always held that if we hold the mental image of a bowling ball rolling down some stairs, that we'll probably be pretty close to what's going to transpire. And the reason for this is that we have a very large, interconnected, gigantic world economy, and it's got a lot of inertia, like a flywheel does. And things tend not to change too dramatically all at once. So my 80% probability has always been that we're going to see long periods of relatively steady decline, then with a sharp drop, and then there'll be these recovery periods. And we've had a rather remarkable recovery period for the past year and a half or so. It's the best recovery that approximately $6 or $7 trillion of freshly printed money can buy. And I expect to see more of that as we go forward, because in this story, the resources don't run out all at once, and the oil doesn't suddenly go to $200 or $300 a barrel and shock the system. Those are fairly rare events. The much more probable outcome is exactly what we're in the middle of right now. We're going to have these apparent recoveries. They're going to get truncated for whatever sets of reasons. We're going to have financial media that's going to try and pin the blame on something other than what's really the case, which is we just have too much debt and our energy costs are really high. So again, that's the most probable outcome. We also spend time around here preparing for maybe the improbable or the less likely outcome, which has a fairly high chance, you know, it's not zero, where there could be a rather sudden break that really does throw things into a bit of a turmoil for a while. That could be some attack on Iran that comes forward that suddenly does vault oil by a factor of two, perhaps. It could be some sort of a disaster in the derivatives market that ends up taking out a couple of big key players. That's almost happened a couple times as we've gone along here. It could just be some ill-timed words from the Chinese finance minister. Who knows? So there's always a possibility that in this global hyper-interconnected system that we have, of something much more dramatic happening, but it's not the most likely outcome.
Got it. But presumably that's why investing now for your resiliency is so important, is because you can't forecast those unexpected events, and so you want to be as prepared as possible for if and when they do happen.
Well, why not? It's very cheap insurance. It does not cost a whole lot compared to the benefit you would receive from that insurance if it ever had to pay out. That is the absolute definition of good insurance.
All right. Question number two comes from user PDB. One of the things that attracts this user to you, Chris, is your positive outlook on the potential for the future. They write about asking to learn more about your plans for future Crash Course chapters and hoping that they include a discussion about community-focused actions that might help people envision a future worth working towards. Can you share those plans, and who are the people you turn to for inspiration around that type of topic?
Great question. You know, we have a set of seminars coming up, one at the end of this very week, over this weekend of March 23rd through 25th at Roe, and then one later out at the end of June, stretching over that final weekend of June into the 1st of July at Kripalu. And both of those seminars are designed exactly to talk about how it is we want to incorporate the information, the implications of the crash course into our lives. What we really care about here is not so much that everybody figures out how to maybe, you know, protect a little more of their wealth than the next guy or you know, is finds a way to squeak through. We want people to be happy, healthy, living into this period with as much purpose and joy as possible. There are really so many examples out there in history, Russia being a prime one, when the USSR broke down in economically and became Russia and the satellite states again. What happened there, what we saw was that most people, of the deaths that were recorded, over half of them were because of alcohol consumption. And people had housing and they had food. What they didn't have was a sense of purpose. What they didn't have were jobs. What they didn't have was that other thing to live for, because what they had was a narrative that said, I need a job in order to feel purposeful. I need to be plugged into the system in order to have something that I can attach myself to. If that goes away, there's no reason, if that being your job or the larger infrastructure somehow changes, that shouldn't lead you personally to collapse on inward on your own self. So we spend time really thinking about how we want to be. This is one of these great moments in history where we get to ask some of those awesome fundamental questions, which is, what really gives me a sense of purpose? How do I want to be remembered? What kind of jobs do I want to work in? Which ones do I not want to work in? Where do we find hope and inspiration? And my personal inspiration lately, the people I've been turning to, are those who really can help guide us on our inner journeys to figure out how it is that we can become the masters of our own domain, meaning that whatever happens in the outer world, I want to have the calmest, most centered mind frame so that I'll be in the best position to react or respond to whatever's happening around me. I don't want to be full of anxiety. I don't want to be freaked out. I would like to come into this, whatever's going to happen next, whether it's a really positive future or one that's going to require a lot of attention, whichever future comes, I want to be standing there with as much calm, certainty, and purpose as I can. So there are a variety of books and teachers out there. We'll go over some of those at these weekend seminars, and I'd be happy to tell people about some more of those. These are not, I don't think, for everybody, but they certainly fit for me at this particular stage of my life right now. And some of them are Eastern and some are Western. There's sort of a hodgepodge at this point.
Great. Well, for those people that are looking to learn more about these upcoming events, the two you mentioned, the one at Roe and the one at Kripalu, they can go to the front page of chrismartinson.com and look at the upcoming events module on the page there. You'll find links to both of those seminars and be able to get more information about them. I will make a quick plug that the Roe seminar is actually this coming weekend. So if you're listening to this and potentially have an interest, something that I would recommend looking into quickly.
And for a more recent example of somebody who also has given me inspiration, right here on our very own website, search out a podcast with Charles Eisenstein.
That was a good one.
He was very much in the vein of what I'm talking about in this response to this question.
All right, great. All right, next question comes from user Aggravated, who writes, what's your advice for those who live or work in cities? This is one we get a lot, the urban prepper.
Absolutely. Well, if I lived in a city, the first thing I'd want to do is make sure that I'm as prepared as I can possibly be. We think of three types of preparations. There are physical preparations, so there you're going to do what you can across the bottom of Maslow's hierarchy of need. You want your shelter, your food, your warmth, things like that, as attended to as much as you possibly can, with the idea of building a little resiliency, a little buffer in there. There are financial steps that apply to everybody. Doesn't matter if you're rural or urban. Those steps should be taken as well. That's primarily about moving your money into safe locations and places where they have a much better chance, your wealth and your funds, where they have a chance of withstanding whatever might come. Knowing that that's hard in the post-MF global world of really knowing what's safe and what isn't. And then the emotional preparations, which I just talked about prior, those are very important, and they apply, again, equally, whether you're rural or urban. The idea here is that what you want to do is get yourself into a position where you are ready for whatever's going to come mentally. And the first step of that for us has always been around making sure you have a good, clear understanding of what's really going on, what the predicament really is. And that means, you know, we have all sorts of tools around that. The crash course is a tool. It's a way for us to get a lens that we look through, but that's just a high-level lens. We have other lenses built in there that we talk about at the seminars, which are around how you interpret the news and what you filter out and how to separate facts from opinions. And these are all things that are just designed to get us and our minds wrapped around the idea of what's really going to come and how we know who we can trust and who we shouldn't trust. And ultimately, what I would like to promote here is that for anybody, city or rural dweller, is to trust yourself. Your gut will tell you when it's time to shift gears, and you'll know what to do if you really listen carefully. In the meantime, I want everybody, rural or urban again, we have this incredible, wonderful resources still exist. The economy is still chugging along. The sun rises every day. There are a lot of opportunities out there. So I guess I'm saying, be sure to stop and smell the roses. Make sure you're still living, that you're happy, and that you're not anxious. And if you find yourself in a city just being anxious all the time because you're in a city, well, then you're probably a candidate to consider relocating.
Yep, good advice. I think it's probably worth saying as well that we have many readers on the site that are from cities. One of the complaints we hear about people living in urban centers is that building community is difficult. And while I think that very well might be the case, it's certainly not impossible. And don't dismiss it out of hand as something that can't be done, because we have lots of examples from people on the site that have worked hard at building community, even though they're in an urban setting.
Great.
Next question comes from user CNB Baldwin. What existing technologies do you think will be most dependable in a peak oil future? For a homestead, apparently. Are there systems you particularly recommend investing in or implementing now?
Oh, absolutely. Of course, both solar technologies, the photovoltaic panels, very dependable, tried and true. Also, the solar thermal panels, people have heard me talk about those a lot. Those are great. I mean, with just a couple of hundred watts, you can of electrical power use a circulating pump, you can have 1970s technology giving you hot water. And I consider hot water to be one of four things that makes being human a really, really good thing. Refrigeration's another, music's another. They're just a few things, but hot water is one of them. There are technologies out there that I'm actually quite excited by, which really do break the mold of the centralization that we've seen of everything, but power generation in particular. I love these combined heat and power systems, the CHP systems, cogen systems, which will allow a small-scale electrical generation to be conducted on site, where the heat that comes out of these systems is no longer a waste product, but it's actually a very useful product in winter, obviously, but in summer you can use a heat differential to drive cooling as well. So there are a number of technologies that are out there. What I'd like to say here is that we don't need any new ones to be developed. It is entirely possible to build a zero footprint house now, meaning just footprint in terms of needing energy to be imported on site. And there are a number of things that we can do that are really simple. Think how much differently our country would be positioned now if we just said this: every new house that's going to get built from, pick a number, 1980 onward, if possible, needs to be oriented to the south. That's it. You know, don't orient it to the road. Just twist it towards the sun like people always used to do. There were some things we got away from with our energy abundance, with our subsidy that we got from nature, and we can re-implement many of those right now. It's not complicated. It's not really sexy because it doesn't involve nanoparticles. It's just simple stuff, common sense. And there are, of course, a number of ideas out there that we can implement right now that make economic sense. No matter where oil goes up or down, they make economic sense today. No matter where energy costs go, if you can control your cash flows out off of your property to every extent possible, and that involves A, conservation, B, some of these technologies I talked about, and often C, with very little actual changes to our current lifestyle, even just tiny modifications can make, in many cases, a huge difference. So those are all things that I would highly recommend people be looking into right now. It's around changing our some of our habits, a little bit of how we do things, investing a little bit in our own homesteads, and they deliver some very large returns.
Great. I'm just going to tack on to that, Chris. Is there anything in particular that you've done in your own homestead besides the solar arrays that you mentioned that you're particularly grateful that you've done? I know one example relatively recently. I think at the end of the last year, you got a simple pump for your well, correct?
I did. We drilled a second well. Our primary well is 400 feet deep, and we had good information from an old guy lives up the street who'd had his well drilled many years back, that there was a lot of ample water right down beneath our feet. So yes, we punched a second well in. We have a static water line at about 50 feet down. It's only flowing around 3 gallons per minute, but we thought that was sufficient, and we put a simple pump on that, which we're going to use. Simple pump, for those who don't know, is a very simple stainless steel contraption. You can either hand pump it, or in about 5 minutes, you can bolt on, take the handle off and bolt on a solar pump, a DC pump. And we're going to use that option for the summer months. It's going to pump into a holding tank, and we're going to use that to water our garden with. Should we ever need to hand pump water, of course, 5 minutes, reverse the process, put the handle back on, and we have water. This to us is really important because we just, this year we had Irene, a hurricane, it was a category zero when it hit the coast about 100 miles from here. It was barely a tropical depression when it came over, and it was sufficient to pretty much ruin our area here and left us without power for about 5 days. And then we had a freak snowstorm in October, which left us without power for another 4 days here, but up to well over a week in surrounding areas and up to 2 weeks south of us down in Connecticut. And we also had another just simple windstorm at some point in June, which also left us without power for almost 5 days. So we've had 3 incidences this year so far where we've been without power. And for people like myself who are on a well, no power means no water. So, you know, that was something that we felt was really important, to get an independent water-based system for us so we could at least have fresh water anytime we wanted. So we've done that. We put in new windows. We re-sided our house with a product that won't need any touching for 25 years, because of all the things I want to worry about over the next 25 years, siding isn't one of them. And these are examples of some of the improvements we've made, and we'll be talking about all of these at the seminar too.
All right. Just doing a quick time check here. I'm already going to make the call that we are not going to get through our entire list again this time, just like last time. So for those folks who submitted questions that we don't quite get to, don't worry, we'll get to them at a future podcast. All right, next question comes from Mama Mia. Do you have plans to present a more European perspective in the future?
Well, very good question. Yes, absolutely. Certainly want to include the European perspective. We are one world now. There's a lot of interesting things happening over there. And of course, I think we're all connected in this story. So when I was over in Spain recently at the invitation of James Turk and attended the Gold Money Conference there, I met a very interesting gentleman there, Alistair McLeod, who writes just beautifully, really on many conversations while I was there with him. He impressed me as somebody who really understands the situation, the technical details, but also how to explain it really well. So we are going to be working with Alistair to bring on a European perspective. And I really need someone who's living in the system and feet on the ground over there, because it's just, I think you get such a better view from somebody who's there. And he really struck me as somebody who could deliver.
Great. Yeah, having talked to Alistair, I'm very excited for him to start contributing. I also want to let anybody listening from Asia know that we're not ignoring the needs of Asia as well. One bit of news in that camp is that we are going to have our first version of the Crash Course translated into Mandarin Chinese up on the site in just a couple of weeks with the launch of our brand new site. All right, next question comes from user Giraffe OK. What is your advice about leaving some money in the system, e.g. banks, brokerages, credit unions, that type of thing, especially with regard to retirement funds?
Well, I still have a retirement fund that's in the system. It's an IRA. It's a legacy from my corporate days. And I know that for many people, they've got sufficient funds that and need for cash flows, that having money in the system is not just a reasonable thing to do. It's an essential thing to do. And I do, you know, I hope everybody was paying attention during the MF Global debacle. There are other warning signs out there that would suggest to us that we really want to be very careful about which institutions we're working with. I don't know if I can say this legally, so I'm gonna hedge this carefully. But there are certain very large banks out there that I would absolutely not be working with right now, simply because of their derivative exposures. In fact, you know, my personal list is my personal no list is very simply found at the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, the OCC. If you Google OCC plus derivatives, they put out a wonderful quarterly report. And if you scroll on down through that big PDF, you'll find a table which will show you the top 25 banks in terms of derivative exposures. Anybody who's in the top 10 or 15 of that list would be an institution I would be very leery about working with at this particular juncture. That's just my own personal measure of safety. As well, though, for people who do have money in the system, I understand, like, this has got to be one of the most challenging, and I'm putting air quotes up here right now, investment environments that we've ever seen. I talk with people.
You're putting air quotes around investment, correct?
Investment, right. Because this is, I talk with people who've been in the business for decades, who've you know, very actively managed and traded funds, and they're, some of them are just getting chewed up, and the rules seem to be getting changed, and what used to work doesn't work anymore, and there's just incredible competition, and we're all fighting with robots now that are actually, I think, about to break into the nanosecond trade execution environment. It's incredible what's going on out there. And against this backdrop, we have to understand that really all of this is happening because trillions and trillions are being printed out of thin air, which means we're all speculating to some degree. This all points to the idea that unless you are really confident, unless you can manage your money on a minute-by-minute basis, literally in some cases, unless you are willing to dedicate that kind of time, I highly recommend that you work with financial advisors who, A, see the risks that are going on out there, B, understand that return of your principal might be more important than return on your principal, who are more concerned about making sure that your money is safe than beating their peer groups against the S&P, that there are a variety of measures I would use in selecting and working with somebody who could put that dedication and focus into making sure that my money was as safe as possible. My own family still has money in the markets. My relatives all do. Practically everybody I know does. I've got my IRA there, and I've still got money in the system too. It's an essential part of life, and it probably will be for quite a while. So we have to make the best of it.
Well, good answer. I'm just going to remind folks as well about the recommendations that we provide to a few financial advisors that we have begun endorsing. So without getting further into it here, since we mentioned it on the previous interview that we did, I'll just let, if folks are interested in hearing the financial advisor that we recommend, email us at support@chrismartinson.com. All right, next question comes from user Stan Robertson, who asks, are you concerned about confiscatory taxes or other liquidation challenges imposed in the future when those who have bought physical precious metals today go to exchange them for other forms of wealth?
Of course, Stan. We all have to be worried about that. I'm worried a little bit more about other forms of wealth first and foremost. I don't believe that we will see gold singled out ahead of other asset classes at this point. Where will the government go first for needed revenues? Well, we've already seen, I think, the future, you know, has been played out in a couple of places. We saw Ireland impose a one-time, again, let me put air quotes up, one-time, because I don't think it's going to be a one-time thing. Air quotes are going around one-time. Tax on pension holdings. We've seen, already there have been little trial balloons floated out that maybe money market funds ought to have special treasury bonds put into them instead of other holdings. These would be the kinds of moves that I would expect to see first. So if the government was really going to start, gets in a pinch, decides to start taxing things, we could do worse than to look at what's going on over in Greece. The sales tax gets hiked first and foremost. Secondarily, we're going to see potentially one-time special taxes on pensions and things like that. We might see the income tax rates. We probably will see the income tax rates get hit and hiked. We'll see capital gains get hit and hiked. Maybe even we'll see, I thought I saw another trial balloon, a couple of congressmen, I believe, were going to hold a hearing into whether, there were undue windfall profits being bestowed upon Apple and other tech companies at this moment in time. These are the kinds of things that tell you, listen, you know, when a government or any government, set of governments gets into fiscal trouble, they're going to be looking for revenue anywhere and everywhere they can. I'm not that worried about it with respect to gold at this stage because, frankly, it's such a tiny piece of the pie. It would be a really difficult thing to enforce, and it would probably have a lot of unhappy people. The trouble to return ratio on that, I think, is rather poor.
Okay. Well, good point. All right. I guess at that point, too, I think one thing to keep in perspective, too, is just the size of the precious metal markets versus the size of some of the other markets that you've mentioned in terms of retail sales or housing or whatnot. It really is quite small. So if you're in the government and you're looking to extract maximum rents, you're probably going to go after some much larger pools of money first.
Yeah, oh, I was trying to make that point. Gold is just minuscule at this stage. But, and thanks for bringing this up, if gold goes to $5,000 or $10,000 an ounce, or much worse, if suddenly Saudi Arabia says we no longer accept dollars for oil, we'd prefer gold, those would be moments where I would have big red flags waving before my eyes, because that would mean that A, gold was no longer a small market, or B, that we needed it for national security reasons. Getting oil imports is a matter of national security. Or, you know, finally, if gold gets remonetized, I would expect, however, in every one of those circumstances, that if there was some form of confiscation, that there would be remuneration with that confiscation. Remember, back in 33, a lot of people, I think, use the term inappropriately. They say gold was confiscated, sort of implying that it was just taken. It wasn't. It was exchanged, maybe not for something you wanted, but it was exchanged at what was then a fair value. It was immediately devalued against that fair value, but you know, there was at least some sort of compensation that came along with that. I would be highly surprised if that didn't happen this time too, were gold suddenly needed on a national basis for some purpose.
And you know, to the spirit of Stan's question too, if any of those developments happen that you just mentioned that would set up warning bells in your mind, we would be publishing an alert about that to our users.
Oh, we will be weeks, hopefully months ahead of that development. Absolutely.
Great. All right, next question comes from Nicomen, who was very kind and said he really enjoys this interview format of the ChrisMartinson.com audience interviewing you. He asks, would we consider doing it regularly, something maybe like quarterly?
Well, absolutely. I would love to do this. I love responding to these questions, and it lets me know where your minds are at, and it gives me a chance to cover some territory that's both new and old. In this particular juncture of history, I don't think we can possibly overstate or repeat ourselves too much in terms of what's really important. And I would absolutely commit to doing this on a quarterly basis.
Great. Well, from what we've seen so far, I think the demand in terms of questions for you is definitely going to be there. All right, next question comes from Woodman. He says that you've talked a lot about the changes you've made in terms of your vocation, where you live, the type of community you wanted to be a part of, and your health. How much more change do you feel you need to make or you want to make in your lifestyle going forward?
Well, I just want to be in a position where if I come out and work with your trainer, Abdul, again, that I can actually set forth and do the challenges he gives me. It's incredible. Anybody who's out in Adam's way, I'm telling you, you got to go see Abdul. He will make you feel like there's more work to do in life. So it's incredible.
I'm laughing, but it hurts because I happened to actually see Abdul this morning and I'm still sore.
I'm sure you're still sore. So I made all of my really big changes, all at once, sort of Pareto rule. I feel, the 80-20 rule. I feel like I made most of the big changes I wanted to make in relatively short order. And now I'm at the position of really poking around the edges. So the things that I care about most right now are really extending well beyond my own personal homestead. We've got everything sort of prepped as much as we think we can. Very happy with where our garden is, and the orchard's just going to do spectacular this year. And a lot of our systems are sort of operating reasonably well. So I feel good about all of that. My next big area of inquiry is really around, and I can feel it coming. There's something like the crash course in me. I mentioned this in the first of this series as well, but there's really something here around how it is that we are going to really step into this new future, whatever it happens to be. And that's what's really captured my attention for the moment, is this sense of that something very momentous is happening, that we get to be participants in that. I want to find ways that we can, let me speak for myself, I want to find ways that I personally can step into a higher role of engagement with what's happening out there. And this engagement's going to be both at my community level and everything I can possibly do through the website, maybe through additional books, other videos, whatever is necessary to reach as many people as I can reach, to add in our voice to what I think is becoming a real, really interesting swelling of voices who are saying, wow, the status quo no longer works. We're going to have to figure something else out. Part one of that story is what's broken and why. And part two of that story is well, what are we going to do about it? And that's the part that really has captured my attention right now. So in terms of personal advancement, to me, that's kind of like a lifestyle decision, because I'm the kind of person, before I can really talk about something, I have to do it first. So I'm figuring out how to really modify my lifestyle in some very profound and important ways. And the good news is I'm happier, I'm healthier, and I feel quite positive about both my personal situation and about the future that we could have.
So just to repeat that back to you, it sounds like you're feeling pretty good about sort of where you are on the lower levels of Maslow's hierarchy of needs in terms of the main things you've taken care of in your life over the past couple of years, and now you're looking to move up that pyramid more to sort of a purpose and an identity level. Is that accurate?
That's exactly right.
All right. Something tells me that the community here is going to be very interested to hear what you learn as you go through that, and be very eager to begin to get some instruction and guidance that you may have for how people can do the same thing in their own lives. All right, next question comes from Citizen Man. What would your recommendation be to organizations that direct investments at institutional levels, such as pensions?
Oh, first thing, if I'm in a fiduciary role at a pension, first thing I'm going to do is I'm going to knock back my assumed rate of return to something that's actually reasonable and realistic, given A, the past 10 years of history that we've gotten, B, what's really likely going forward. Many of these pensions are still holding 7.75, 8, sometimes even 9% implied rates of return or stated rates of return going forward. And that's just not possible.
They're just not going to see that. But when you said you were going to knock back, I thought you were going to suggest a couple of stiff drinks.
Well, I might want to do that first, and then I'm going to have to knock back my stated rate of return to something more realistic. Is 0% unrealistic? Maybe not in some cases, but it certainly would be at least half what many of the current rates are. And so that raises a much larger question. You know, the pensions need to get their minds around some very big, large structural forces that are in play. Forget about energy for a minute. Let's pretend the energy tax, which is just, you know, climbing and been there and absolutely it's got, you know, many years of trend under its belt. Let's just look at what we see demographically, you know, with the idea that many of our pension systems are, if for want of a better word, they are pyramid style arrangements where you need more people coming in to pay off the people who came before. And we just don't have that demographic base, not in the US. They don't have it in Japan. They don't have it in Europe. And so just demographically speaking, when you understand that people, you know, go through the cycle of life, they go through peak earning years, which translates into peak savings years, and then they step into retirement and they become net dis-savers as they spend what they saved. That's the phase we're in right now. So again, set aside whatever concerns we have about what the implications are of peak oil on growth. Just on that one basis alone, I think we could make a very compelling case that we're going to have fairly lackluster returns. And that's if we didn't have a moving target out there. And that moving target is the value of the currencies themselves. The second big risk that I'd be worrying about if I was in the pension world would be, what's this money going to be worth? Because I would take it very seriously. You know, people have invested and trusted their money with myself as one of the trustees who's going to, in the future, be delivering that money back to them at some stated rate. Well, if I'm going to give you $1,000 a month in the future or $2,000 a month, I want to be sure it's worth that, or at least is keeping pace. And today, you know, extraordinary risks with how much money the central banks are printing and with how much the governments are deficit spending. So if I was in a big pension and I had those institutions, they've got weight. They have really serious clout that they could bring to bear. If I was some of them, I'd be all over the news saying, we do not agree with this amount of money printing or this amount of deficit spending, because both of those represent extraordinary risks to the future value of their holdings for all of their beneficiaries. So I've really been surprised that the pension funds have been as quiet as they have been, just sort of, you know, taking their lumps and I guess kind of hoping that, you know, they won't do any worse than their peer group. But I think this requires something a little more extraordinary than that. There's really some extraordinary risks, and they should be, and this is a judgment, stepping up to the plate a little bit more with their concerns and being much more public about them. But the final thing is I would really look at how all of this money that's been collected by pensions, let's imagine I'm a county pension in a state, And I take all this money that I collect from people who work in my county, and then I ship it out of my county. Off it goes. And it goes where? To Wall Street. And they do stuff with it, sometimes fraudulent things. But it ships, whether they do fraudulent things or not, irrelevant here. What happens is my money leaves the county. And hopefully it goes out into the world and does great things. If I was in the position of running those one of those pensions, I would certainly be considering right now how I could take that same money and bring it back and have it operate within my own community so that when it's doing its good work, when people are taking that capital and becoming more productive with it, creating products with it, delivering services with it, building businesses with it, whatever they're doing, that then I would get sort of a double or maybe even a triple bottom line a benefit to my county. Because what would happen is not just would people have jobs, not only would services and goods being produced, but there would be these other benefits as well that accrue when you spend your money locally. So that would be probably the final thing I would really think about for some of these pensions. Absolutely would be, where am I putting that money to work in these, particularly given everything we know about how the world's working right now.
I'm really glad you brought that up, because I was going to ask about that, because as you know, we've had several pension funds ask us about our opinions in exactly that matter. And I think you described it all very well. I think maybe the only other thing I would mention is that when you're keeping the money within your region rather than just shipping it off to Wall Street, there's also the opportunity to define a return on that investment in matters other than just exact dollars and cents in terms of how much money, more money it made last year than this year. And that's a measurement of resiliency. So if you're investing that money into energy production at the local level, into creating a better food shed, or into creating a more dependable watershed for your territory that you're a steward for, those are all very good things that people who have a trustee responsibility should be thinking of. And that's just another factor that these local pensions can be factoring into their models.
Absolutely. And those are, I think, very discrete, very definable, measurable sorts of returns. If you invested in a series of farms in your county, and then you can go out and say, look, the soil is now, doubly improved or this many inches thicker or in some, if you can point to the actual tangible result, which says because of the way we've invested this money and what's been done with it, here's how our county has improved, meaning that whatever future happens to come, our ability to grow more high quality food within our region, that's a positive. And it could be, again, with the insurance concept in mind, it could be a huge positive under certain circumstances that come. But no matter what, it'll be a positive. And it'll be more than sending your money out into the faceless world of, where it heads off to Wall Street and who knows what happens to it once it gets there. That's the old model. I think it's time to start. At least some percentage of those pension assets should come back under this new model, which says, hey, we'd like to know where our money exactly is at all moments in time. We'd like to know the people who are going to be using it. And we'd like to intimately understand what that money is doing. It goes in here, this happens, here's where our return comes from. It's often not as clear as that on any of those counts when it ships out to a big money manager out in Wall Street.
I'm really hoping that we see much more of this line of thinking as we go forward. All right, next question comes from Robert Essien. I hope I'm pronouncing that correctly, especially since he's one of our most prolific posters on the site. Robert says, do you still forecast a hyperinflationary ending to the story? And if so, where are we on that timeline?
Well, hyperinflationary, yes, we're definitely on that path. This is something I've always been, my core belief has been that humans will behave just like they always have. And so far, I have not been disappointed in that belief, and all the data sort of stacked up. If we look at a chart over the past 5 years of the 8 largest central banks in the world, so the Bank of Japan, Federal Reserve, Bank of England, the ECB, broken into its member states, so that would be Germany and France primarily. When we look at these banks, we see that they've grown almost in the past 5, maybe 6 years, about $10 trillion of balance sheet expansion. There is no way they're going to ever be able to reverse that. And I had this discussion with Mark Faber recently and on a podcast. And so when I look at that line, what's really noticed here, I think the most important part that really came out of that Faber podcast was him noting the observation which I've heard elsewhere as well, and made the same observation myself, which is that these crises, they started kind of smallish, you know, long-term capital management, that was a gigantic, gigantic problem back in 1998. It was about a $3 billion hiccup, right? Which was huge at the time. It was an unthinkable amount of money. And, you know, Federal Reserve and Greenspan had to intervene. And now we look at that and we just laugh. $3 billion, really? That's nothing. You know, that's Tuesday morning for the Federal Reserve now. So it's just extraordinary when we look at the frequency and the amplitude of these interventions and the amounts of money that are being required and the really sort of tepid, lackluster response that happens on the other side of those actions in the economy itself. What we notice here is just the overall trend is that things are speeding up. We are getting less and less out of more and more, less and less actual economic reaction out of more and more monetary stimulus. This is very much what we were expecting to see. This is very much, unfortunately, not a surprise. Where we are on this timeline is that the thing that is different about this story is that it involves the whole world right now. It's not just one country with nice defined borders around it where people can scurry across those borders and get away. Much of the world today is denominated by very, very large concentrated players. It's not you and I that they're really worried about. It's what do you do with the funds that are actually in control of hundreds of billions of dollars? And if you are in control of one of those funds, like, I don't know, Norway's sovereign wealth fund, where do you put that money? Like, how do you sidestep what we're seeing out here with the balance sheet expansion in the central banks, aka money printing? This story right now is one where I don't see any way for them to reverse those steps. I don't see anything for them to do but continue those efforts. I don't see anything beyond increasing those efforts as we go forward. And so in this game, you know, this is, I'm going to contradict at least, you know, a little bit of my very first response, which is, you know, what is this really, how does this unfold? For the most part, I think what happens is the banks print and print and print and print, and everybody kind of says, well, it's uncomfortable, but it seems to be working, and nobody else seems to have cared so far, and where would they go? And that will progress along as far as it can, and then someday that will change. And when that does change, it could be relatively radical, by which I mean my expectation would be a fairly profound turn, for example, in the United States fiscal capabilities at the government, U.S. government level, or in the value of the dollar, changing over a matter of just months, just a few months. And to me, that would be a, you know, breakneck speed in this particular story. That would... You know, this is the hyperinflation one's a tricky one because, you know, how do you measure that? But really, ultimately, we live in a faith-based system. We have a debt-based monetary system. We have to have faith. We have to have faith that the money has value. It's a social contract. We have to have faith that not too much of it's going to be created compared to goods and services. We have to have faith, given the amount of debt that's out there in the system, that the future is going to be a lot larger economically than the present. That is, that when those claims come due in the future, we would like to trade those claims, debt, money, for things. And if there aren't more things in the future, but there's more of these claims on those things, well, that's the story of inflation. Maybe even the story of hyperinflation, which to me goes beyond just monetary excess and transcends into that next stage of loss of faith in paper money. I've personally lost my faith. That's why I'm such a big holder of gold and silver. Other people, once they see it this way, tend to lose their faith as well. This is becoming more and more mainstream as time goes on. We are seeing more and more people who are very well-respected, very established players in the monetary field, people who have made entire careers trading for paper, starting to look at this story and say, yeah, I'd rather be holding something other than paper at this point in time. And it's not just gold. You know, it's really in all of the other tangible things that we can get our hands on. So I would expect that if and when we start to see a shift away from paper back to things, that shift is going to be fairly dramatic, and it's going to unfold probably in less than a year, maybe in just a matter of months, where we would see prices for a variety of things really, really skyrocket.
All right, well, that's a lot to digest, but it provides a good segue into what I'm going to make our last question here. We've done it again, Chris. We've made it through another one of these interviews, and again, not gotten to half the questions that we had hoped to, but we'll have to pick that up on our next podcast. So with that said, let me take it home here with the last question that probably is a natural segue in many folks' minds after hearing your answer to the last question, and this comes from user Jay Barney. How bad are things going to get? Power outages, mass protests, food riots, etc. Do you see things being this bad, this dark?
A very important set of experiences for me was living through hurricanes when I lived down in North Carolina. The most potent of those for me in terms of learning was Hugo. Came through in 89. I lived, 3 hours from the coast. It hit as a Cat 4, and by the time it got over us, it was maybe still a Cat 2. He was a beast, Hugo was. And he had the benefit of arriving after we'd already received, for no other good reason, 4 or 5 inches of rain in the prior week, so the soil was loose. And so here he comes with his 80-plus mile-an-hour winds and just made all the trees in the area. It was just like pickup sticks across our driveway. And it was a real mess. We were without power for 2 weeks. I had to use a chainsaw laboriously to cut my way out of my own driveway. What I learned from that experience was that people really pulled together. And it was an extraordinary time in my memory to think back on how close people were and how we did pull together. That to me was a metaphor that carried forward to the point when I was looking into the future as I see it right now, and when my wife and I were making decisions, where did we want to live? Picking the community we lived in was incredibly important to us because where we lived in Hugo, I will guarantee you, behaved very differently from parts of New Orleans. And so, that was a function not of the brutality of the hurricane. That was a function of how the people responded. And so this is really important point to me is that what I care about most is not actually what transpires, because the economy falling apart itself or food coming in tight supply or anything like that, people will respond to that and we will make do. What I care about a lot is how we respond. How are we mentally prepared and emotionally prepared, and how are we personally going to respond? Are we going to be in a position of truly being selfless and helpful in those moments, or are we going to be needing help in those moments? And that dividing line really is going to be a function of how well you're prepared across these three areas we continue to talk about, which is your financial preparations. Those are going to count. Your physical preparations are going to count. And your emotional preparations, all of those are going to count. And it's that last one that's really important that we're going to have the opportunity to dive into at this weekend seminar coming up at Roe, which again, this weekend also at Kripalu. And that's a topic that really lends itself and I think requires the kind of intimate face-to-face meetings that we engineer for ourselves when we have these seminars. Because it's very difficult to sort of write about it and it needs to be personally translated and transmitted. And so both my wife and I have a lot of facility with really talking through what is it, what is going to happen and how will we react and what comes up for us and how can we best manage those responses. That's something that absolutely everybody can get facility with and I think should. Absolutely should, because when whatever transpires, whether it's a brilliant future that somehow free energy comes out of the 0 point boundary or something, or we have a fairly disruption filled future, whichever of those outcomes happens, understanding our own responses and stepping into both of those as fully as we can, that's how you win. That's really where life, I think, comes together, and so. I'm holding on as somebody who saw how a community can respond if it has in its DNA the idea that it's going to take care of itself, take care of its own, and it will do that because that's just how they operate. And I think that's the kind of framework that I want to share and talk about, and then hopefully people will be able to bring that back into their own communities, wherever those happen to be, after the seminars.
Good. Well, thank you for taking what I had feared was a fairly alarming question and answering it with such positivity and optimism. Feel much better.
And let me, as long as I have to finish that out too around the seminars, because we will be talking physical preparations there, and we'll be talking financial, and we'll be bringing in some financial experts to go through some detailed questions of whatever people might have on their minds. So this is a full weekend that's really around all three of those areas, but we spend a little bit more time on the one that's harder to talk about in writing.
Great. Well, with that, let me just make one last reminder that the Roe one is actually this coming weekend. So if anybody is still on the fence, act quickly. And beyond that, Chris, we have now made it through the interview. Thank you once again. And I look forward to doing this again with you in probably about a month or two.
All right, Adam, the pleasure's been mine, and you're a great host.
You're too kind. Ouch, don't make me laugh. It hurts still.
All right. See you next time.
Take care. Bye-bye.
This concludes this podcast by Chris Martinson. To gain further insight into where things stand today and what might happen tomorrow, please visit chrismartinson.com. That's chrismartinson.com. Please join Chris Martinson next time to continue your journey toward awareness, understanding, and action.